were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic. Oh, I can now hear the sailors cry. Smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. I don't have to fear that I wanna rock your gypsy soul. Just like way back in the days of old. Yeah, magnificently we will fold into the mystic. That foghorn, you know I will be coming home. Yeah, when that foghorn whistle blows, I gotta hear it. I don't have to fear it, and I wanna rock your gypsy soul, just like way back in the day. Together we will fold into the mystic. Come on, girl.
The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news article, checking level, adjusting cam, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we made it to a Friday, so, you know, we got that going for us, right? That's a good thing. Welcome to the show. I've spent the last hour or so back and forth trying to watch what's on the TV to get the latest news out of Hamburg. And my goodness, talk about a dichotomy of sorts between, there's the split screen going on. You've got, on the one hand, the pictures, they're all the leaders of the G20 countries, the 20 wealthiest nations in the world, all dolled up at a big concert this evening, at a beautiful concert hall. And on the other side of the screen, you have pandemonium in the streets. And the protests, you know, on one hand, there are people who I believe are trying to protest peacefully. And they're protesting just about everything. They're protesting capitalism. They're protesting the G20, the fact that the 20th wealthiest nations in the country are there at this one gathering to decide what happens to the rest of the world. You've got environmental protests. You've got Trump protests. You've got Putin protests. You've got all these different factions. And then you've got the anarchists. You've got people who are just out there wreaking havoc for havoc's sake, or so it seems. I got to hand it to, you know, every big event like this, you see one guy. Remember the Stud Scud from one of the Middle East wars? I get them all confused. This time it's Keir Simmons from NBC News. He's out there, you know, outrunning the water cannons and the tear gas canisters and the pepper spray, and watching, you know, standing right there with his bicycle helmet and his microphone and his cameraman as these hordes of riot police run by. They go after one guy, they take him out, and they run back. It is utter pandemonium. One thing I took sort of a little bit of, I don't know, pleasure, shouldn't get pleasure from it, but a playful hint, glimmer of pleasure, reading a report that Melania Trump was stuck in her residence because of all the violence going on outside. I don't know how true that was, because allegedly she went in to interrupt the meeting between Donald and Vlad the Impaler, because they were running so long and they had to get ready for this big concert tonight. Go figure. Anyway, I say the residence because this is just another example of the ineptitude of this administration. They've known about the G20 for how long? I don't know how long, but for a long time. And nobody thought to make hotel reservations. So they wanted to stay at the Four Seasons. Well, the Four Seasons was booked. I think the Saudis got the Four Seasons. And by the time they finally got around to making reservations, everything was booked. There was the chance. They actually thought about staying in Berlin and helicoptering the Trumps in for each event, until the city of Hamburg finally came up with a residence to put the delegation up in while they're there. Really? I mean, this is what happens with inexperience. And don't we remember how they talked about how, you know, Barack Obama was so inexperienced, he wasn't up to the job. Well, this guy has zero government experience, and nobody around him who did either. So anyway, there's that little aside. It is a Friday. I apologize for my voice. This has been a hell of a week. As you know, I told you I told you last week I was going to do my withdrawal from the opioids thing over the weekend, and thought that a 4-day weekend would be enough to get me through it. Wasn't really enough. Yesterday was probably the worst day of all. And I got to tell you, my heart goes out to people who are addicted to heavy doses of this stuff, because I was taking such a small amount and I'm still having the withdrawal symptoms from it. So more power to you when you go through this. But I think it's important to do, because, you know, my biggest fear was if I didn't get off of it, it would take more and more to make me so that I wasn't sick. Because what I felt, it does relieve the pain, I will say that. But in addition to that, if I would miss a dose, or if I was a little late, I'd all of a sudden start feeling fluish. I just wouldn't feel well. And I would pop a pill, and then, you know, 20 minutes or so later, I'd start feeling better, feel a lot more like myself. My fear was it would take more and more of it to get me to that feeling like myself place. And I wanted to go in the other direction. So I made the decision to bite the bullet, take the 4-day weekend and kick it. But unfortunately, it took longer than the 4 days. So, you know, we got through yesterday's show. I thank you for that. And then so, yeah, hopefully we'll get through today, and then I'll have another weekend. And by next Tuesday, all should be well with the world, right? Knocking on wood laminate here. So today was the big long-awaited day. Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin met face to face. So first they're in this very antiseptic looking white room. It's only six of them. It's Vlad and Don, right? It's Rex Tillerson and Sergey, not Kislyak, the other one, the foreign minister, whose name is escaping me at the moment. You know, it's another Sergey. Somebody in the chat room tell me, the other Sergey. Kislyak was the ambassador who was recalled. But Tillerson's basically his counterpart in Russia, and two translators, Lavrov. Thank you, Truman Town in the chat room. I knew one of you would, Lavrov, I think it is. Thank you for coming to my rescue. So it's, and the two translators. So it was just them. It was supposed to go on for 30 minutes. And when you figure the translators are going to have to, translate everything, that's like 15 minutes. Well, it went on much longer than that. So they first get in the room. And of course, there are reporters there. And if you can hear over all the camera clicking, can't they use, digital cameras that don't make the clicking noises?
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. President Putin and I have been discussing various things, and I think it's going very well. We've had some very, very good talks. We're going to have a talk now, and obviously that will continue. But we look forward to a lot of very positive things happening.
It's going to be great.
For Russia, for the United States, and for everybody concerned. And it's an honor to be with you.
Your Excellency, Mr. President, we spoke over the phone with you several times.
This is the Russian translator now, if you can hear it.
On very important bilateral and international issues.
Well,
phone conversation is never enough, definitely. But if we want to have a positive development in bilaterals and be able to resolve most acute international topics and issues, definitely, we need personal meetings. And I'm delighted to be able to meet you personally, Mr. President, and I hope, as you have said, our meeting will yield positive results. The good news for us, yes.
Okay, and there, oh boy, the sound of the shutters is just deafening. So that was louder than what they said. The second voice you heard was not actually Vladimir Putin. That was the his interpreter. I cut out the Russian interpreters because I figured it was already noisy enough. We didn't need to sit through, you know, 30 or 40 seconds of Russian speaking. All right. So I see that. So the DSLRs do have the shutter sound. The other cameras are. And Putin does speak English. Absolutely. But I guess for this sake, they used interpreters, and you know, Dump doesn't speak Russian. So anyway, because it was only the six of them, there was nobody in the room to do the official readout. So that was left to Rex Tillerson. Now, I know it's going to be kind of a snoozy thing, but I do have Rex Tillerson's statement. He came out afterwards, spoke to the press, but just like Sean Spicer does at home, no cameras were allowed. They recorded audio, but the audio couldn't run live. So they recorded it and then released the audio afterwards. And don't ask me why, just a power trip, I think. Anyway, here's what Rex Tillerson said about the meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin.
President Trump and President Putin met this afternoon for 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Wow.
Here on the sidelines of the G20. The two leaders exchanged views on the current nature of the U.S.-Russia relationship and the future of the U.S.-Russia relationship.
Okay.
They discussed important progress that was made in Syria, and I think all of you have seen some of the news that just broke regarding a de-escalation agreement and memorandum, which was agreed between the United States, Russia, and Jordan for an important area in southwest Syria that affects Jordan's security, but also is a very complicated part of the Syrian battlefield.
You know, I'm gonna break in here because the part of Syria that the ceasefire is under is the southwest part of Syria. That's where Assad is based. So that's his home headquarters. So the part that he controls, there's going to be a ceasefire. That's not where the alleged gas attacks were taking place. That's not where we bombed. It's not where the rebel outposts are. It's the part that Assad controls. So it's not as encouraging as it sounds at first blush. Just thought I would add that in there in case you were wondering.
This de-escalation area was agreed. It's well-defined agreements on who will secure this area. A ceasefire has been entered into.
To Russia's benefit.
This is our first indication of the U.S. and Russia being able to work together in Syria. And as a result of that, we had a very lengthy discussion regarding other areas in Syria that we can continue to work together on to de-escalate the areas and the violence once we defeat ISIS, and to work together towards a political process that will secure the future of the Syrian people.
We'll see.
As a result, at the request of the President Putin, the United States has appointed, and you've seen, I think, the announcement, a special representative for Ukraine, Ambassador Kurt Volker. Ambassador Volker will draw on his decades of experience in the U.S. diplomatic corps, both at the as a representative to NATO and also his time as a permanent political appointment. The two leaders also acknowledged the challenges of cyber threats and interference in the democratic processes of the United States and other countries.
Oh, really?
And agreed to explore creating a framework around which the two countries can work together to better understand how to deal with these cyber threats, both in terms of how these tools are used to interfere with the internal affairs of countries, but also how these tools are used to threaten infrastructure, how these tools are used from a terrorism standpoint as well. The President opened the meeting with President Putin by raising the concerns of the American people regarding Russian interference in the 2016 election.
He did.
They had a very robust and lengthy exchange on the subject. The President pressed President Putin on more than one occasion regarding Russian involvement. President Putin denied such involvement, as I think he has in the past. The two leaders agreed, though, that this is a substantial hindrance in the ability of us to move the Russian-U.S. relationship forward, and agreed to exchange further work regarding commitments of non-interference in the affairs of the United States and our democratic process, as well as those of other countries. So more work to be done in that regard.
That's an understatement. More work to be done in that regard. Basically, if you could decipher what Tillerson was saying, Vlad said that it never happened. It did not happen. And Trump basically said, okay, well, we'll agree to disagree. In fact, at the end, so I don't know if that was his entire statement or not. It was all I could grab. At the end, they took some questions. Sean Spicer played, referee. And I got the very last question that was asked, which was on that subject.
Thank you very much, Sean. Mr. Secretary, can you say if the president was unequivocal in his view that Russia did interfere in the election? Did he offer to produce any evidence or to convince Mr. Putin?
The Russians have asked for proof and evidence. I'll leave that to the intelligence community to address the answer to that question. And again, I think the president at this point, he pressed him and then, felt like at this point, let's talk about how do we go forward. And I think that was the right place to spend our time rather than spending a lot of time having a disagreement that everybody knows we have a disagreement.
Really? That was a more productive way to spend our time because everybody knows we have a disagreement. So we'll agree to disagree. Meanwhile, there's already Germany has an election coming up. And apparently there's already, what are they saying, fingerprints of Russia trying to do the same thing using fake news. And in this case, it really is fake news. You see, what Donald Trump does is he conflates things. He takes the thing that is fake news. And make no mistake, there was a ton of fake news being propagated throughout the entire election. We know that there were bloggers, there were paid bloggers all over Russia. And if you disagree with me, feel free to call in 954-889-6410 or Skype to Nicole Sandler. But there were many of them, like thousands of them from Russia, who were just churning out all these fake stories that were put out through places like Breitbart and lesser known places, just fake news sites that had sprung up to propagate this fake news. It was everywhere.
Propaganda, 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 propaganda.
You get the idea. That was one of the ways they infiltrated our electoral process. There were other ways as well, but that was one of the many ways. So there was this fake news thing. What Trump does is he takes that whole concept of fake news and says, basically, anybody who is critical of him is out there, you know, guilty of fake news. And so he's saying it's CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC, the mainstream corporate media, who I am not a big fan of. Although I got to say, lately, the New York Times and the Washington Post have been doing exemplary work. But here's a little bit of Donald Trump just in recent weeks.
Let me just say, the press is very, very dishonest. And I think people are wise to the press.
The media isn't just against me. They're against all of you. That's really what they're against.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
The press has become so dishonest that if we don't talk about it, we are doing a tremendous disservice to the American people. Tremendous disservice. We have to talk about it to find out what's going on, because the press honestly is out of control. The public doesn't believe you people anymore. Now, maybe I had something
because
to do
you tell
with
them not to.
Never be intimidated by the dishonest media corporations who will say anything and do anything to get people to watch their screens or to get people to buy their failing papers. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people. Even our enemies back there, look at all that press. Among the most dishonest people in the world.
So he's calling all the press dishonest, painting them all with one broad brush, except he never called out the people who were actually lying and making shit up. Did you hear the governor of Maine, Paul LePage, actually admitted in a radio interview that he makes shit up and he plants it out there just to see the false stories be planted? It is opposite world. That's exactly what it is.
Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, opposite world.
You know, when you have somebody like George W. Bush talking about the importance of a free press.
I consider the media to be indispensable to democracy. That we need an independent media to hold people like me to account.
You think?
Power can be very addictive, and it can be corrosive, and it's important for the media to call to account people who abuse their power, whether it be here or elsewhere.
Absolutely. And in the days of George W. Bush, we really didn't have this fake news phenomena. There weren't there were some bloggers, but they weren't out there purposely writing stuff that was 100% made up. Now, there were a lot of opinion pieces that were flat out bullshit, but they weren't propagating false narratives and putting it out there as if it were news, waiting for it to get spread around like wildfire on Facebook and Twitter and being picked up by mainstream media outlets. Did you see Rachel Maddow had a segment last night that somebody tried to trick her? That they have this send it to Rachel website where for leaked information or for tips or for whistleblowers. By the way, we're going to have our whistleblower guy on Wednesday. I'll tell you more about that as we get closer. This is a new phenomena that really propped up, really started it during the Obama administration, where you had all of the Trumpets, for example, spreading around bullshit about, you know, he wasn't born in the United States. That's when fake news got started. Actually, it got started long before that. And it was, Fox. Fox has been the fake news outlet for years, years and years. And I guess they saw how well it worked there. And they decided to, or the Russians and others decided to use it on a bigger scale to get what they wanted done. In fact, it's being used now. It's being used in the fight against voter fraud. It's something that doesn't happen. There is no in-person voter fraud. Dead people are not voting. People are not live. People are not voting as dead people. People are not voting in multiple states. But you got Kris Kobach, who's been spreading his fake news for so long that it infiltrated Fox and these other outlets, and you got all the lemmings repeating the bullshit. So now they think, oh, this is happening, and now we have a problem with voter integrity. We do have a problem with voter integrity. They're trying to keep us from voting. So This is a subject that is in the news now because we have the Department of Justice sending a letter to the Secretaries of State, not just Kris Kobach's commission, but the Department of Justice demanding that the Secretaries of State of each of the 50 states turn over all this voter information, all their voter data. So we're going to take a break. We'll get what's news out of the way, and we'll come back on the other side with Ari Berman of The Nation, who's written extensively about voter suppression tactics in this country, and get his take on what's going on with that. Okay? Okay. And you know what? Do I have the right one here? Let's see. Yes. Okay. I just have the wrong date on it. All right. What's news? And we'll be right back.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
After a day in Poland during which the president criticized his predecessor, the U.S. intelligence community, and our media on foreign soil, Trump departed for Hamburg, Germany, the site of the G20 summit, where climate change, trade, and other issues will be discussed. World leaders arriving were met with massive protests and police in riot gear. Clashes began when police charged at masked protesters at a Welcome to Hell march attended by some 12,000 people. Before the march, police had warned of possible violence and said they had confiscated a number of homemade weapons. Some 20,000 police have been deployed in Hamburg for the summit, and security cordons have been erected to prevent protesters from reaching the venues. Up to 100,000 protesters are expected in Hamburg during Friday and Saturday. Friday is also the day for the scheduled first meeting of the U.S. and Russian presidents, but we have little to no way of knowing what will have been discussed, as there are reportedly only six people in the room. Rachel Maddow explains.
The only other people in the room besides Trump and Putin and two translators at that meeting will be Rex Tillerson, who was personally awarded the Order of Friendship by Vladimir Putin for his friendship to the nation of Russia. The only other person besides him will be Sergei Lavrov, last seen receiving code word top secret intelligence from Trump in the Oval Office and tricking Trump into allowing into the Oval Office a Russian photographer and his bag full of electronic equipment. So it'll be just the four of them, making sure America's interests are protected in the face of Russia's unprecedented recent attacks on our country. Sure, that should go fine.
Meanwhile, CNN is reporting that Russian efforts on U.S. intelligence gathering have stepped up in recent months.
Since the election, U.S. and law enforcement agencies have detected an uptick in suspected Russian intelligence officers entering the U.S. under the guise of other business. Now, officials we've spoken with say that the Russians have been replenishing their ranks ever since the U.S. expelled 35 Russian diplomats suspected of spying last December, as you'll recall. And in some cases, Russian spies have tried to gain employment at places with sensitive information as part of their intelligence gathering efforts, these sources say. One former senior intelligence official familiar with the concerns described it as a, quote, aggressive collection posture, and the official added that the effort was undeterred by the election meddling success. The FBI, which of course is responsible for counterintelligence efforts in the U.S., would not comment for this story, and requests for comment from the Russian embassy and the U.S. were not responded to.
Back at home, lawmakers are wrapping up their 4th of July holiday week off, getting ready to head back to D.C. on Monday and Tuesday, many having gotten an earful from their constituents at home about their efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And a good sign for everyone who will ever need health care, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell signaled that it's not looking likely he'll get the 50 votes he needs to inflict such hardship and pain on the American people.
If my side is unable to agree on an adequate replacement, then some kind of action on with regard to the private health insurance market must occur. Where we end up if Republicans are not able to agree among themselves is the crisis will still be there, and we'll have to see what the way forward is at that point.
Even Pennsylvania's Republican Senator Pat Toomey admitted they weren't prepared because they didn't think they'd be in the position to try to overturn the Affordable Care Act.
Seeing how difficult it is to get a Republican consensus, until the election last fall, which surprised me, I didn't expect Donald Trump to win. I think most of my colleagues didn't. So we didn't expect to be in this situation, and given how difficult it is to get to a consensus, it was hard to force that until there was a need to. And so that's what we've been working on. I will also say that there's been a new wrinkle in this, right? The early idea of how we would handle this difficult challenge was to pass a repeal bill that would be pretty much a clean repeal, stabilize the individual market, and set the repeal effective several years hence, and have the opportunity in the meantime to work out the reforms. That's all been collapsed now into a shorter time frame.
On Thursday afternoon, Walter Schaub, the Office of Government Ethics chief who clashed with Trump over not divesting from his business, announced he'd be resigning. Walter Schaub with CBS News.
Do you think the president and his family are using the office to enrich themselves?
I can't know what their intention is. I know that the effect is that there's an appearance that the businesses are profiting from his occupying the presidency. And appearance matters as much as reality.
But at this point, it sounds like you're saying you can't be sure.
You can't be sure. And so it almost doesn't matter whether they are profiting or not. America should have the right to know what the motivations of its leaders are. And they need to know that financial interests, personal financial interests, aren't among them.
Schaub taking a new position as a senior director for ethics at the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, a nonpartisan group that advocates campaign finance reform and litigates voting rights cases. The U.S. economy added 222,000 jobs in June, according to the Labor Department. The unemployment rate rose slightly to 4.4%, hovering just above its lowest level since 2001. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler, inviting you to check out my full show Tuesday through Friday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. We're 100% listener funded, so please contribute what you can at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back. And as always, I'm happy to welcome our next guest to the program. Ari Berman is a senior contributing writer for The Nation, where this week he wrote about the Kris Kobach voter suppression plan in the form of a, quote, election integrity commission. He also had a huge piece in the June 13th issue of the New York Times Magazine, The Man Behind Trump's Voter Fraud Obsession, how Kris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, plans to remake America through restrictive voting and immigration laws. Ari, after spending a couple of years researching and writing Give Us the Ballot, you've become the de facto expert on voting rights in America, but it seems like they keep moving the goalpost on you.
Well, there's certainly no shortage of stuff to cover, Nicole. I mean, every time you think one issue has gone away, another pops up. And I started working on this piece about Kris Kobach before he was ever named vice chair of the Trump election integrity, quote-unquote, commission. So this just keeps escalating in terms of what they're trying to do, and I think it's now very clear that the GOP under Donald Trump plans to make voter suppression one of their main priorities and one of the only ways that they plan to try to stay in power.
We do have problems with voting in this country. The problem is that it's not easy enough for most people to vote. I was reading, I loved reading the comments on your New York Times Magazine piece, and I came across one from Australia where somebody said, I don't understand it. You're supposed to be the greatest democracy on earth. Over here, we have there are penalties to pay if you don't vote. Everything is done to make sure that everybody can vote. In fact, they bring voting machines to like nursing homes so people can vote. And now, you know, it looks like what's going on over there, meaning over here, is everything's being done to keep as many people from voting as possible. That's really what's going on, isn't it? But a certain kind of people.
Well, I'm glad that you read the comments because I never read the comments on any piece I write. It's one way that I stay sane.
I understand.
But it's true that, you know, even in our best days, the U.S. has 60% voter turnout. So we lag behind the rest of the developed world, industrialized world, when it comes to voter turnout. We're 31st out of 34 countries in industrial democracies when it comes to voter turnout. And then on top of that, we have all of these new efforts to make it harder to vote. So instead of saying, how can we get 60% voter turnout to 70% or 80%, which you'd think people were doing, or Australia, where they have compulsory voting, so basically turnout is 99%, instead we're implementing strict voter ID laws, we're purging the voting rolls, we're making it harder to register to vote, we're excluding entire classes of people from voting if they committed a crime. And so all of those things are going on, all under the pretext of stopping voter fraud, even though voter fraud is a virtually non-existent problem in American elections. And what I'm concerned about is we've seen all of these efforts to make it harder to vote at the state level. In Florida, where you're from, in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, in Texas, you know, I can go on and on. But now we're starting to see it happen from Washington, D.C. And I think what Republicans are doing with this Trump Election Committee is they're trying to federalize this effort. They're trying to centralize it. And they're trying to both encourage as many states to do these kind of things as possible, but also to try to have the federal government use its influence to do it as well. And I think that's absolutely chilling, because we just came out of an election that was the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. We know from intelligence reports that voter registration systems were accessed by Russian hackers in 21 states. Those are the problems we should be focusing on, not a commission that's just going to lie about voter fraud in order to make it harder to vote.
What is the reason that the Trump administration has given for the need for this voter fraud commission? Is it Donald Trump's claim that 3 million, to use his words, illegals voted in this election, that otherwise he would have won the popular vote?
That's the only reason that I can tell that this commission was set up. Donald Trump tweeted that millions of people voted illegally. He had a bruised ego over the popular vote. Even before the election, he had made all sorts of insane comments about how the election would be rigged, how people were going to vote 10 times in places like Philadelphia. And so he really laid the groundwork first for blaming if he lost on fraud with no evidence. And then even when he won, he said that he would have won the popular vote if not for 3 million people who voted illegally. Of course, there's no evidence of that. I think a lot of people thought he was just joking when he said we're going to set up a commission to study this, but lo and behold, it actually happened. And not only that, but he chose one of the most aggressive champions of voter suppression in the Republican Party, Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, to be the vice chair and the functional head of the commission. And then people said, oh, haha, let's see if it actually does anything. And then, of course, last week, they sent letters to all 50 states asking for voter data that the federal government had never asked for before, including people's Social Security numbers, party affiliation, military history, criminal history, and that set off a massive amount of alarm bells, because first off, the federal government's never asked for this history from states. Secondly, what are they planning to do with it? A lot of people don't trust this commission. They don't trust Kobach because they believe that it was only set up for one purpose, which was to try to prove Trump's lie that millions of people voted illegally and then put in place all of these suppressive policies as a result of those lies.
Right. And so, Ari Berman, but actually, Chris Kobach has gotten a lot of this information already because of his interstate cross-check program. In fact, I spoke with Greg Palast the other day, who he believes that many of the states who are now balking at turning over this information already have, just under the cross-check program, not under this new program.
Well, I would say there's a distinction there. I would say it's one thing to give stuff, information to CrossCheck, which is a private program that's run between states, than to give it to the federal government,
uh-huh.
Which is a completely different thing. I don't know if Kobach can use his information on CrossCheck. There's limitations on that information for a nationwide voter list, like he's trying to do with the White House. So I think they are separate things, and I think some people have gotten these two things confused. I'm concerned about CrossCheck. I'm not saying I'm not concerned about it, but I think what Kobach asked for here was well beyond the data that he has for CrossCheck. He's not getting people's criminal history. He's not getting their military history. He's not getting all of these things through CrossCheck. I'm not sure he can use this information. I think if he tried to use the information from CrossCheck, which is private, which is run among states, for a federal probe, I think some of the states that are part of CrossCheck would balk at that. I don't know. Maybe I'm being naive, but I think those are different issues. But yeah, it's obviously disturbing that he already has a lot of this data one way or another.
You for the New York Times piece, it's something everyone should read. I will post a link to it on my blog along with today's podcast at NicoleSandler.com. You go into great depth in Kobach, who is now, he's announced he is running for governor of Kansas.
Yeah, so the reason why he is now running for governor of Kansas. So, I mean, first off, there's just an inherent conflict of interest with him being vice chair of a national election commission and running for governor of a partisan office in a state. I mean, to me, that alone should have disqualified him from taking any part in this commission. You think it would be enough for him to be Secretary of State and run for governor of Kansas. But the thing I wanted people to know about Chris Kobach is he's really the leading architect of laws restricting voting and restricting immigration, because I think a lot of these people think of these issues as separate. But before Kobach became Secretary of State of Kansas, he went all around the country drafting anti-immigration laws for states like Arizona, advised people like Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County, was the architect of quote-unquote self-deportation. And basically the idea was make lives so miserable for immigrants that they'll leave the U.S.
Right. He was also, he was behind the Show Us Your Papers, Please law, the SB 1070. Right.
He wrote that law. Exactly. And he was the guy, he was the go-to guy who wrote this kind of legislation. If you were a politician and you wanted to put in an anti-immigrant ordinance, you called Chris Kobach. That's how it was really his calling card. Then he became Secretary of State of Kansas, and he made this new argument, a preposterous argument, but a new argument, which is that all of these illegal aliens, as he called them, were registered to vote and needed to be purged from the voting rolls or prevented from registering. There was no evidence of this, but what Kobach did is he fused anti-immigrant sentiment with policies that restrict voting rights. Like in Kansas now, you have to show your birth certificate, your passport, or your naturalization papers to be able to register to vote, because they have documentary proof of citizenship to register to vote, which has blocked 1 in 7 Kansans from registering, which is an unbelievably high number of people to be blocked from registering to vote, let alone voting. And because it only applies to people that registered after 2013 when the law went into effect, nearly half of the people on this list of blocked voters are under 30. So it's disproportionately affecting younger people. It's disproportionately affecting new registrants, obviously. It's disproportionately affecting people who are less likely to be Republicans, even in a red state like Kansas. And so I think this combination of anti-immigrant sentiment with voter suppression is incredibly dangerous. I think Donald Trump is trying to do this now. I think Chris Kobach's the person who put it in Donald Trump's ear that millions of people voted illegally, and I think a lot more people need to be aware of what he's doing.
It is frightening. You know, I usually don't read the comments either, but the New York Times Magazine, they had, like, recommended comments, and so I looked at some of those because I wanted to see what people were saying, if they were as outraged as I am, as they should be, and they were. There was one comment from a woman who said, I tried to register to vote in Kansas as a Democrat, and, you know, she had a non-immigrant name, you know, a very Anglo-sounding name, but she was young and wanted to register as a Democrat, and her papers kept getting rejected, where she had to take time out, she had to send in her birth certificate, then she finally had to take it in person. She said most of the people she knew gave up because they weren't going to spend the time or the money it took just to register to vote.
Now, of course, and so again, I'm glad you read the comments. I didn't realize that they were so enlightening. I think the comments on the New York Times Magazine are a little bit different than the comments on The Nation.
Yes.
When I normally write for them. But I will say that that most people do not carry a birth certificate, a passport, or naturalization papers around with them. This is not like a driver's license, which cannot be used for proof of citizenship in Kansas. Most people don't even have these documents on them readily available, and they're expensive. It costs $100, for example, to get a passport. Most people don't know where their birth certificate is. Unless you're naturalized, you don't have your naturalization papers. And so people don't have these on them, and I think most people, if they're blocked from registering once, they're not going to bother to register again. Most people are not that dogged about doing this. And this law really bordered on the absurd. I write in the piece about a 91-year-old World War II vet by the name of Marvin Brown, who once paid a poll tax in the 1940s. And when he came back to Kansas to re-register to vote, he didn't show proof of citizenship. And Kobach actually said, we don't know if he's a citizen. And this guy, at 91 years old, was not too happy about this, and he sued Chris Kobach. And so I think this is the kind of impact that these policies are having.
This is one of those solutions in search of a problem. Are there any documented cases of someone voting twice in different states? Anyone ever been convicted of that?
It's very rare. It happens every once in a while, but not often. So, I mean, Kobach has this program called CrossCheck that you talked about earlier, which compares state voting rules for double voting. And it's very inaccurate because it only runs the data based on first names, last names, and date of birth.
Mm-hmm.
So a John Smith in Kansas can easily be confused with a John Smith in Iowa
right.
If they have the same name and birth date, which happens a lot more than you'd think. So you get these headlines of thousands of people have voted twice, and then you drill down on the data, and only a few people have ever vote twice. And usually it's because they're confused about requirements. So Kobach in Kansas is the only Secretary of State with the power to prosecute voter fraud cases, and he's convicted nine people in a state with 1.8 million registered voters.
Wow.
He's only convicted one non-citizen of voting illegally, despite saying this is rampant. And the eight other people that he convicted, they were almost all over 60. They were people who owned property in two states. Most of them were registered Republicans, and they didn't realize that if you own land in Colorado, you can't vote in Kansas. Now, that is illegal, but most people were just confused about the law. Like, someone would vote on a water utility referendum in Colorado, right, then they would vote for Congress in Kansas or something like that. So, I mean, it's not that it never happens, but it's a very, very small problem. It's usually people who are confused about the requirements and who should not be prosecuted for voter fraud because they didn't know that they did anything wrong.
Right. Do we have any instances of, like, dead people, people voting as a dead person? I mean, what I'm getting at is there are billions of votes cast every year.
No, I mean, exactly. I mean, this is one of my favorite stories about Kobach was before the 2010 election, he had a press conference, and he said that 2,000 dead voters in Kansas were registered to vote and were an opportunity for voter fraud. And he named one person, this guy Alfred K. Brewer, and he said, you know, there's a record of Alfred K. Brewer voting in the 2010 election.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Wichita Eagle followed up, and they found Alfred K. Brewer was alive doing chores in his front yard, raking leaves. And Kobach had confused Alfred K. Brewer, the son, with Alfred K. Brewer, the father. And this is so unbelievable because Kobach held a press conference announcing this dead voter had voted without actually even checking to see if the guy was still alive. And that's the kind of sloppiness that we see here, which is, you know, we hear allegations about dead voting. We hear allegations about double voting. We hear allegations about non-citizens voting. Usually it's just a misunderstanding. Usually it's just a mistake. Very rarely does it actually occur. It never occurs on the scale of 3 million people voting illegally, like Donald Trump said. There's been tons of studies on this question. None of them have found anywhere close to that number. At most, there were probably a few hundred cases of fraud, most of them not even intentional in the 2016 election, nowhere near 3 million.
And percentage-wise, it's like it's such a minuscule thing. When we actually have issues around our voting, we know, I believe the intelligence agencies that say Russia interfered with our elections. They got into in a number of different ways. Whether or not they influenced the outcome, I can't say. But the fact is that is an issue. There are issues around our voting that could use election integrity and a real election integrity commission, right?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, so the first thing I would do was examine all of the impact of these new voting restrictions on the election, whether it's voter ID laws or making it harder to register to vote or all of those things. Number one, I would examine the impact that had. Number two, I would look at what we could do to try to increase voter turnout. Because as I said, we're last among industrialized democracies when it comes to voter turnout. And then I would also look at the problems with our actual voting system, because we know that hackers accessed registration systems in 21 states. We have a lot of issues. 42 states are using voting machines that are at least a decade old. They could crash at any time. I'm working on an article about this right now that's going to come out next week, so I've been spending a lot of time on this. That's the kind of thing we should be looking at, not this virtually non-existent problem of voter fraud.
You know, this is nothing new. I know Chris Kobach is sort of the poster child now for this, but there's a clip that I play all the time. I'll play it again. It goes back to 1980. It's Paul Weyrich here.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So this is the long game for them. They've been working on this. That was recorded back in 1980. This is not a new strategy.
No, this is not a new strategy. They've been trying to do it for a very long time. I lay out in my book all the different ways that Republicans over the years have tried to limit voting rights. I think what was different back in the 1980s is that you still had Republicans in Congress that supported things like the Voting Rights Act, mm-hmm. that supported things like voting rights. You still had moderate Republicans who controlled states who did not suppress the vote in places like Wisconsin. That has really changed dramatically. Now you have the Republican Party marching virtually in lockstep with these things. Every once in a while, you'll get some sort of bipartisan rebellion like we saw with Kobach's voter data, where it's even too much for many Republicans. But by and large, there's been very, very little dissent within the Republican Party when it comes to efforts to make it harder to vote. And that voting rights in general have just become dangerously politicized. And with Republicans in control of so many states, so many important swing states in control of now the federal government and really committed to this effort, it's very scary. It's not a new strategy, but the strategy has been dramatically escalated of late.
Right. Not only did Kobach's office send out those letters, but the Department of Justice sent letters to the state secretary of states saying that they're reviewing state voter roll maintenance procedures and they want all this information. This is a whole new scale. So what are Democrats doing to counter this?
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, Democrats don't have a lot of power right now, unfortunately. They don't control that many states. They don't control the Congress. Obviously, they blew an election they should have won in 2016. Mm-hmm. So I think the Democratic Party is not doing a whole lot on this scale to push back. And I think what really pushed the needle with this Kobach voter data request was the fact that Republicans said no. Now, obviously, I realized some of them had already given Kobach some data through CrossCheck, but at least with this new request, the fact that Mississippi, Louisiana, Arizona said no, that's what really had an impact. If it just had been California or New York, it wouldn't have had the same kind of impact. So I think it goes to show you that Democrats can't do this all alone. And it also shows the importance of local elections, which I think Democrats have badly neglected.
Yep.
State legislative elections, Secretary of State elections, governor's elections, that stuff matters tremendously, as you know, Nicole, in states like Florida. And that's been ignored by the Democratic Party, and I hope that becomes a priority, not just winning the White House, not just taking back Congress, but these state offices is where so much of the action is headed on voting rights.
Ari Berman, it's always great to talk with you. The book that we mentioned is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It's as important now as ever. And the piece in we got a current one in The Nation, another one next week, and the New York Times Magazine. I'll link to that as well on my blog. Thank you, as always, for coming on the show. I always appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Nicole. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye. Ari Berman, I'm telling you, he is the guy. He is the guy when it comes to voting rights and what we're losing. It is incredible that there really aren't documented cases of in-person voter fraud. You know, that was the whole thing about voter ID. They were saying people were showing up at the polls and saying, I'm John Smith and I want to vote. And it used to be all you had to do was sign your name in the book. Well, you know, and it used to be they'd just take it and you'd go in and vote because people don't show up to vote, you know, when they don't show up to vote regardless. They're not going to show up to vote for the other guy. Except the really nefarious ones. And but the really nefarious ones seem to be on the other side. But now if they were really serious that they wanted to make sure that was you, they would take any kind of photo ID. But that's not what they're doing. It's the kinds of photo IDs. For instance, in Texas, a student ID is not good enough, but your gun permit is. Because you know, they know if you have a student ID, you're more likely to be young. And if you're young, you're more likely to vote Democrat. If you have a gun license, you're more likely to maybe be older and white. Driver's licenses, they like driver's licenses because the people who are more apt not to have a driver's license are the elderly or the young or the minorities. Right. And people who don't have their birth certificates readily available and like that. It's just wrong. And, you know, when I asked what the Democrats are doing to counter it, I was more interested in really asking what have they done all along? And the question is certainly not the answer is certainly not enough. They really haven't. They haven't. The Republicans have been playing this long game since, you know, 1980 and long before that, knowing that this was what they wanted to do. And I wonder when is too late, too late. I'm going to be recording an interview, actually, after the show with, this woman, Nancy McLean. She's done a whole bunch of interviews of late because she's got a brand new book out called Democracy in Chains. Holding it up to the camera. The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Maybe we'll air it next week. But it talks about how far back this goes. And, you know, the Koch brothers, they've got their tentacles in it. The John Birch Society, even before them. This has been the long game. The Democrats, I think, tend to think we have truth and honesty on our side. This is we're the good guys, so the good guys always win. Well, these days the good guys aren't winning. We need to fight harder. And I hope that the Democrats have learned a thing or two from the dirty pool that the Republicans have played. They're winning because they lie, cheat, and steal. It's not about democracy anymore. It's about I don't know what it's about. A quick time out for a little bit of humor, because we have the time to do it. And then I've got a closing comment to make. So our friend Lauren Mayer has a new song.
Donald Trump has been offensive ever since he's been around. So why are folks still shocked when his behavior breaks new ground? Stop wondering what his latest comments about a woman's face meant. Apparently rock bottom has a basement. Starting with his birther crap, or saying John McCain's no hero, claiming immigrants are rapists, or the tax he paid was zero, or the greedy way he cashes in from tacky hotel placement. Still, it seems rock bottom has a basement. Rock bottom has a basement, they keep lowering the bar. But Trump's enablers haven't given up on him thus far. The awful way that he shames women's looks keeps getting clearer. Of course, that gets us wondering, has Trump looked in a mirror? Just saying. Claiming he'd only grab women if they're skinnier and hotter. Plus the disgusting way he talked about his older daughter, who's a fake, complicit hypocrite. Trump's kids do what he taught them. Anyway, there's a basement to rock bottom. Rock bottom has a basement full of Trump's enormous lies. He rejects the Paris Treaty while insulting our allies. Republicans act outraged and Trump's tweeting they deplore. But they'll ignore their scruples if he helps them screw the poor. And women and immigrants and the environment and regulations that protect consumers, etc. Trump fawns all over Putin and ignores the Russian hacking. And officials who investigate him, he tries to send packing. Though the GOP knows he's a racist, unhinged yeller, apparently rock bottom has a cellar. His side doesn't know the meaning of self-effacement, or what dignity disappearing without a trace meant. Trump's utter lack of grace doesn't matter to his base, because apparently rock bottom has a basement.
That is Lauren Mayer, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago on our Funny Friday show. Quick programming note. Yesterday when Howie Klein was here, he told you he's doing a Reddit Ask Me Anything on the Sanders for President subreddit. It's at reddit.com/r/SandersForPresident. If you want to go over there, it starts in about 3 minutes or so. Howie Klein at the Sanders for President subreddit. He's doing an Ask Me Anything. All right. So it was 1 year ago today. Today is July 7th. 1 year ago today was a Thursday. And at the time, I was still working with Randy Rhodes. Remember, we had built she built the studio. I helped her with it and put this new studio on the air. And we were going to work together. And that day, things were so horrible. That was the day I knew that this partnership was not going to work. And it got so ugly in there. Tempers were flaring. It was not a fun day. When I left the studio, I was literally shaking. I was shaking and crying and not doing well. And by the time I got home, I just wasn't feeling well. And I laid down and fell asleep for a little while and woke up a couple of hours later, drenched in sweat with all the symptoms of a heart attack. So I went to the hospital, and it was in the x-ray that they took of my chest where we found there was a mass on my lung. Sometimes blessings come in the weirdest forms. So listen to your body. If something seems off, pay attention. If not for that day, 1 year ago today, I hate to think of where I'd be right now. So thank you, Randy Rhodes. And a year later, I'm, you know, coming up on a year cancer-free. With that, have a wonderful weekend, everyone. I'm going to go back to my opioid withdrawals, and I will be back here on Tuesday with Gotta Laugh back from vacation. Thank you for listening, and be vigilant. Do the right thing. Have a great weekend.
Stumbling onto the heart of Saturday night.